Can this technology be used for weather modification? What about weaponry? We'll talk with Bob Kuntz and John Hutchison about that in a moment. I know many of you are calling us now, so we will take calls, but next hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our two special guests, John Hutchison and Robert Kuntz, as we talk about the Hutchison effect. John, let's talk a little bit of Nikola Tesla and how your work, of course, echoed some of the things that he did. We'll also talk about his death ray and what happened there. But how close, finally, once you started to refine your Hutchison effect, how close did it echo what Tesla was doing?
It was echoing quite a bit. I followed most of Tesla's patents to the letter. Actually, I was lucky to find vintage electronic or electrical machinery in various salvage yards here in Vancouver, and had a great replication of his laboratory. And that's quite amazing, plus the patents and that, too, to follow that through. And it's very interesting because I got to know a gentleman that knew Tesla and had a lot of his diagrams and documents in his home.
Really? You know, the FBI or somebody raided his place after he died, so this guy was lucky that he was able to keep some of those things.
Oh, very much so. Some of this stuff has actually surfaced in the SBIR, DOD contract stuff in my when I was on the program, which is kind of intrigues me. I have it in writing.
How far advanced would you say Tesla was for his time?
Extremely far advanced. He was sort of cut off by J. Pierpont Morgan a bit, but he was pretty advanced, and the whole Star Wars program, or most of it, is based a lot on his findings in that, too.
Yeah, old JP couldn't figure out how he could make money on free energy, right?
Yeah, good old JP Morgan, that's
you
right.
Got it.
I know. Yeah.
Bob, let's talk about this in terms of the free energy. Let's spend a little time on that, then we'll get into the weaponry and the weather modification, too.
Okay.
I agree with you. We should have this now, except every time I go to the gas pump and I keep seeing these prices fluctuate and I see the greed and the corruption that's out there. You look at this disaster we had in the Gulf of Mexico over the last couple months. I keep saying to myself, there's no way they're going to take us down the path of free energy or even cleaner energy. Yet
well,
they could do it today.
Sorry.
Let me just emphasize something here. You were talking earlier about coils and magnets. The Russian Academy of Science experiment involved rotating magnets. That's the Searle effect. That involved free energy. So that's rotating permanent magnets rotating. Then there was Ed Leeds Skounen's work has been replicated by a man named Matt Emery, a student at Purdue University, confirmed what Ed Leeds Skounen said about holding magnets. And that indicates that Ed Leeds Skounen really did know something about the laws of physics that the rest of us don't know something about. And so this guy, Matt Emery at Purdue, created a self-sustaining system that produced power and also maintained a magnetic field. And the physicists at Purdue University, except for one older fellow, wouldn't help him.
Well, that's probably true. And, you know, he did say once that he knew the secrets of the pyramids, so maybe he had them. So
well,
I ask
Ed Leeds Skounen used rotating magnets. If you go to one of
his
websites,
you're right.
V magnets, old Ford V magnets with lots of iron. He'd rotate those V, maybe a couple hundred of those magnets on a wheel, and then he had coils that he would place besides the magnets and captured the scalar energy and piped it into those coil blocks and moved it around, it appears. That's my analysis. Now, this has to be done exactly right, or those coils have to be resonantly tuned. You know, that's the thing. You can't just when John Hutchison replicated Tesla's work, he did so down to the letter. You can't just substitute any old materials. You know, for instance, in Tesla's original free energy experiment, he used very special mica capacitors, and they have a resonance that's very special. So you can't just use any old capacitor and any old piece of copper or any old thing. You have to do this right, and you have to know what you're doing.
Well, that is absolutely true. How, John, could he move down there in Coral Castle, or the Egyptians, and we'll get into the Egyptians in a second, but How could someone like Lee Skolnin move these huge blocks of stone this way?
Really fascinating area because looking at his museum there, he's got some ancient radio equipment in there, bits and pieces of it. So it's maybe he was onto something like this too.
Well, I just let me just indicate again. He had this rotating system of magnets, and he put the coils right next to the system of magnets. The coils are resonantly tuned to the magnetic field energy. Then they piped the energy out to those coil blocks. That's my analysis. So this is resonant capturing of coils.
What if it was zero-point energy captured by minerals? It's kind of interesting to note, maybe for the Coast audience, that in 1996, December 31, Dr. Franklin E. Meade got accepted a zero-point energy collector that was accepted by the U.S. Patent Office. And I investigated that later on and found in around 2005 that IBM bought up all the patent rights to it. It's a principle using round spheres of barium titanate and cubes of it, which seems to follow the power cell stuff I do a little bit.
That's pretty smart, though, at least, to have that. Have you patented, John, any of your work?
No, I never patented anything. I was advised not to patent it. I've been pretty free about it. I've demonstrated on television and showed many, many people the levitation or the crystal power cell technology. And I have been funded a few times by Japan and Germany. No bad energy there, just the funders had other things to do, and we're still friends to this day.
Are you concerned that someone out there can steal this from you?
No, it's open to the public. I mean, that's how I feel about it, and I hope that people can run with it, to be honest.
You're one of a kind, John. What about, don't you want to profit a little bit from this?
No, just enough to get me by and buy some machine tools and hot dates, you know. One of those things. What the heck, you know?
George, let me interrupt here. I just want to emphasize that I consider this a serious national security issue for a number of reasons. Number one, we've got this a terrible economy. Energy is costing us a tremendous amount. You know, again, we've got a $13 trillion national debt. This year, the deficit is $1.3 trillion. All over this country, their governments are writing IOUs, and we're getting ready. It looks like we're on the Titanic. So this is, and also, let me just emphasize, I have a friend who had an implant removed by Dr. Roger Lear, and I analyzed the results of the laboratory analysis of the implant, and it had non-terrestrial isotope ratios. There was a 2% shift in the borium to beryllium isotope shift ratios that appears to be due to electron capture decay that involved a 90-million-year shift in the isotope ratios. So it appears to me that it's possible that we have people, some civilization 90 million years more advanced than us, putting implants in people in the stealth of night. So that's one thing, okay? Now, that to me is a national security issue. When American scientists are being implanted by apparently extraterrestrials, that are, you know, that's a national security issue. So it's economic national security is one thing. And the other thing, you know, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, those people ought to be put on trial for what they're doing. When they have a sighting, let's say an enlisted man, maybe a sergeant or something, or a group of enlisted men, see some of these extraterrestrial spacecraft coming into our weapons laboratories, weapons storage depots, and things like that, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations comes in and tells them they threaten their families and everything. You don't know anything. You didn't see anything, George. Now, listen, you were Naval Intelligence. I was with the Naval Security Group. Is this any way to conduct themselves? You know, don't people need to know about this? Are they going to suppress this? I'm very, 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 very disturbed about this. This is gravely serious. You know, George, we could wake up on a slave planet. Who knows what they're putting implants in people?
Yeah. Well, this leads us right into this as an electromagnetic weapon. In what's out there. I've got to believe, Bob and John, that this kind of technology might have been mastered. You've been doing this for 30 years, John. I'm sure they've been watching you, monitoring you, maybe took some of your thoughts and ideas, experimented with it. They probably had incredible resources behind them to try to find out what they're doing, even beyond the John Alexanders. I got to believe that they've got it in some capacity, but it's a weapon. It's not being used to generate free energy for people. It's a weapon.
Hey, George, who runs these black projects? These blacker than black extra constitutional projects. Who's in charge? Are they from this planet? We don't know who's involved.
We don't know.
With that.
We don't know.
You're relying on these blacker and black programs, but we don't know who's in those blacker than black programs. Listen, I was an instructor at the National Security Agency, and I was in a compartment like everyone else, and I didn't know what Y was doing. If everything is secret, it doesn't make for so maybe some scientist does know about this in say Los Alamos.
What they wanted you to know, Bob, is that you saw the piece of puzzle that you were working on, but you couldn't see the rest of the puzzle.
That's
the way they do it.
That's right. So how are most scientists going to know about this if it's held secret? If it's secret, and also black programs can get shut down. You know, you can have a tremendous, wonderful black project that could save the world with free energy, and the government, whoever's president, just comes in with an axe, whether it's
A few weeks ago, a Russian scientist said that the droughts in Russia, the calamities on other parts of the planet, were being caused by the United States using some kind of electromagnetic weapon. John Hutchison, possible?
Highly possible, yes.
I think it's a false flag. The Russians are the ones that have those scalar electromagnetic weapons, not us. They've had them since 1960 or 70. Dr. Bearden shows on the front cover of one of his books a picture of a Soviet scalar electromagnetic weapon producing a grid pattern.
All right, explain that. Explain the scalar electromagnetic weapon, Bob.
Well, basically, it's a long-range version of what John Hutchison is doing. It creates canceling electromagnetic fields in the upper atmosphere, and it is a kind of a coordinate system. And when you get cancellation of the fields, it produces movement in the clouds. It's a long-range weapon that can reach around the world. Also, you can pump the atmosphere. The Earth is like, you've heard of the Schumann resonance, things like that. You can create scale of standing waves in the environment, in the atmosphere. So I think that Russian scientist was full of it. I don't think the HARP system is doing much. It probably uses some scalar effects, but the Soviets and the Russians are the ones that were big on this 30, 40, 50 years ago. In the United States, physicists don't even know about scalar physics. If you talk to 90% or 100% almost of physicists, they don't know about scalar weapons. The Soviets were far ahead of us. They picked up where Tesla left off. This HARP, everyone worries about HARP. I don't think that does much. But the scalar weapons that the Soviets had, they were blockbusters, and I imagine they still are.
Well,
yes,
you know,
I remember mainstream media reporting some of the effects of cold hole explosions in the air and radio clouds. That's on main media and the Soviet woodpecker.
Yeah, Soviet woodpecker. You can go on the internet, you can hear it. The woodpecker signal.
So, well, do you think they have tested it and it's something's gone awry here, causing these severe droughts over there in Russia?
High possibility.
Who knows, George? I've seen standing waves in the atmosphere that I can't explain. Also, what's going on with these contrails, or they call them chemtrails? You know, I can put up with a certain amount of condensation trails, but some of the stuff is totally insane. You know, you look at some of these pictures of these cross-grid patterns in the sky. Who's producing these effects? This is not ordinary contrails. There's something going on. Now, I'm not saying it may be something in the additives in the fuel? I don't know, but there's something going on with those. Not all of them are condensation trails. Now, people will tell me, you know, oh, that's nonsense. But if you really look in, George, I'm a fairly good physicist. I've been at this 40 years. I look around. I think about things. Those chemtrails, you look at all, some of them are not produced by ordinary planes doing ordinary things.
No, that's true. There's no doubt about that. And God knows where it'll lead us.
Well, listen, I told you, you know, who's running this these programs, these blacker-than-black programs? You know, I don't want to get people too worked up, but this is serious. You know, my complaint is that everything, always in the United States, there's never a sense of urgency. Never a sense of urgency. Here we are, $12, $13 trillion national debt, $1.3 trillion deficits. Extraterrestrials are implanting our scientists. We've got this crazy business going on with the atmosphere. Our physicists tell us that there's nothing wrong. We know the laws of physics when we don't, and on and on and on. You know, I don't know, George. We got to wake up. We really got to start moving. You know, I tell you, I work 15, 16, sometimes I work 2 or 3 days straight. Round the clock, 7 days a week. I haven't been to a movie in 30 years, but I don't see other people. Well, maybe you do. I mean, you work hard. Lots of people do. But we got to get a sense of urgency going here. We can't. This is unsustainable, this whole business that we're in. That's why I'm a little bit hectic or frantic about this.
You don't sound frantic at all, Bob. Not at all. Yeah. What are the Chinese doing about this kind of technology? Do any of you know?
Had a Chinese film crew come here and film. So, they brought their own samples, and it was a block of rubber that turned into a big oily mess on the test target area.
Now, so they're obviously aware of this technology.
Yeah, it was Chinese television, filmed these strange things happening for quite a while, and then they went off to China. I don't know if the show ever aired, but I did actually videotape them. And the effects that were happening with this block of material that turned into this gooey, oily.
When this first started happening, John, when you saw it finally working, I mean, what did you think?
Oh, what, the Hutchison effect?
Yeah.
I wasn't surprised at all. I thought it was kind of a bit of annoyance. It was kind of funny because my business partners at the time and scientists said, well, you know, John was a real wreck because, you know, he'd be throwing out the metal samples in the garbage because he couldn't use them for machining purposes. So they would talk about this years later, of course, and at that time, I being not a scientist at all or not trying to promote anything, I thought, well, it's just a curious type of high voltage effect.
And Bob, how about you? How did you come across the Hutchison effect? How did you know about John?
Okay, in 2002, I was coming down from Altoona, Pennsylvania, to my home, driving along the highway, and I saw one of these unusual tracks in the sky. I had a camera with me, a bitmap camera, and I took 26 pictures of this the system, and I took it home and blew it up in the computer and analyzed it very carefully, and I found a disc-shaped object, a very clear. As the pictures are on my website, drkunst.com, but a very clear picture of a disc-shaped object moving very slowly. This was at 12 o'clock in the midday, 11 o'clock in the brightest, sunniest day you can ever imagine. This was not a thing in the middle of the night, a glowing ball. This was a disc-shaped object that I photographed in the middle of the day. So what I said to myself is, what's going on? How do these things stay in the air? So I started doing analysis in study of anti-gravitic effects. I studied the work of Towns and Brown. I replicated the Brayfield-Brown effect and got an anti-gravitic effect here in my little lab.
Hold on, Bob. More to come when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM, including we'll chat with John about what it was like levitating a 70-pound cannonball. You can see the picture at coasttocoastam.com. Okay, next hour we'll take some of your phone calls. For the remaining half hour, we'll take some of your fast blast questions as well with our two guests, John Hutchison, as we talk about the Hutchison effect, and Bob Kuntz, physicist. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we got a picture of the 70-pound cannonball, John. Kind of explain for us the levitation method here for it, the anti-gravity experiment.
And that was in the giant lab I had in 1988-87 time period, and it was filmed by Brent, and I got kind of nervous when I saw that thing starting to float up. I mean, I kind of backed away, and because I'd seen something that heavy levitating, you know, it could go also into what they call translational movements as well. But luckily, it just hovered there and then found its resting state again.
And, I mean, how high up did it go? Just a few inches?
I'm trying to remember now. I got it on Prime Video, high-definition video.
About a foot.
Some of these are on YouTube, too, right, aren't they?
Yeah, actually, they're on my YouTube channel. Yes, I... What I've done is kind of bad because I used a digital ELF to film a television set and then put it downloaded onto YouTube, so the quality is not that great. But, yes, it's on YouTube. I'm kind of a YouTube fan character here and uploaded a lot of my bits and pieces on my TV shows. I'm trying to improve the quality for the audience because they complain. I don't blame them because it is kind of, some of them are pretty bad videos. Rough and grain and all that kind of thing, but a lot of my footage is sold by Griffin Film Productions as well on the international market.
That, you know, we were talking about the Chinese, and we got a fast blast in from Wichita, and James wants to know if the Chinese have this as a weapon, or do you think it's just, as Bob said, the Russians? What do you think, John?
Unknown with China. Really unknown. I mean, the Black Ops world is full of mysteries, full of leaks sometimes. Sometimes I meet Black Ops people, and they say it's secret. I say, okay, I understand it's secret. I have a friend who investigated the Black Ops world, Nick Cook of Jane's Defense Weekly, and he wrote a book called The Hunt for Zero Point, and run into some very interesting folks doing interesting experiments.
Have you ever been concerned, John, for your own safety, your life? You know, we saw the tragic deaths of Eugene Malov. That could have been a robbery, probably was, but still a tragedy nonetheless, working on zero-point energy and, you know, cold fusion.
That was very tragic, George. I remember that incident. Very, very tragic. No, I never had any kind of threats. I've had spooks come around and pretending there's somebody else and just looking what I'm doing, but no threats or anything. No.
How about you, Bob Koontz?
I've never had an incident of any kind, except once I was in communication with a former Air Force Army officer who was inspecting NATO bunkers for electromagnetic for soundness. And something happened to me as a consequence of that. And also, when I was at Berkeley in 1982, I had something happen. So I would say, yeah, I've had some things that pretty serious things happen to me.
I think so, too. John, of everything
I tend to forget
done.
About them, but two very serious incidents. life-threatening.
Let's talk about the Egyptians for just a moment. If they had this technology, where is it, John Hutchison? Where did it go?
That's a good, very good question, George. Probably buried somewhere in some museum somewhere. I heard about this when I was reading a book called Our Haunted Planet. In these museums around the world, they have artifacts that they can't categorize, so they just leave them sitting in the basements of museums. An example would be a piece of stainless steel that is so old that rock has grown around it. So maybe they had technology back then that could levitate these giant blocks of stone and put them in place. I mean, I worked with the Ark of the Covenant. I was approached by Discovery Channel to replicate the Ark of the Covenant. That's a big challenge to me. Can I do it? You know, I like those kind of challenges. And I said, okay, I'll do it.
Let me just indicate here that...
It worked.
Well, and hold on for a second. Let me get this. How did you replicate it? Based on the Bible? The biblical...
On the Bible's measurements and that. We couldn't afford gold, so we used copper. And we were 6 months into production, and the producers phoned me and said, well, this is a big day, John. Good luck. And I say, yeah, I think I need it. You know, I don't think anything's going to happen, but it did happen. It just seemed to draw in like a giant vacuum cleaner, all this energy, converted into electrical energy that shot between the cherubim, causing a giant fireball, destroyed the cherubim.
Yep.
Scared the heck out of the people that owned the metal supermarket, and we even caught entities coming out of the thing, too, which our cameraman cut all that stuff, and you can briefly see them on the one-hour special.
Yeah, I've produced these entities, too, in my lab. I don't necessarily call them entities. It's some sort of energies, self-organizing system that seems to be alive. It's like an ectoplasmic plasma of some kind. I've had a whole lab area filled with it using canceling electromagnetic fields in a large coil.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But you have to do the physics right in this. You know, people think they can slap things together and they get a null result and they say, oh, there's nothing to it. You have to take your time. You know, again, John Hutchison replicated Tesla's work down to the finest detail. He put 50 coats of lacquer or shellac on his coils, things like that. Yeah, this is not something you can just use any old piece of junk and substitute a capacitor. And the materials are very important. You have to use involve sound waves and phonons and resonant frequencies, material science. It's not, you know, you just can't slap it together.
Well, no, it takes a long time. Practice, trial and error. What's the worst that could happen, John Hutchison, if something goes awry? What if you're in, let's assume you're flying in one of these vehicles that is being propelled by this and the machinery breaks. What happens?
Oh, it'd be a horrendous mess. If the machinery literally broke, it'd be a horrendous mess. I mean, it would be just incredible. It'd be just vaporized, instant vaporization, I'd say.
Is that possible?
Oh, yeah, it's highly possible. I mean, that high-speed projectiles, if anything goes awry with them, they just vaporize.
So not to be played with at home, is it?
Oh, I always kind of remember when a film crew from National Geographic came here and the lady producer, was her hair started floating in the air. And everybody stopped filming and saying, John, are we going to be okay? And I said, don't worry about it. It's just a little bit of electrostatic going on here.
I would guess, John, that when people see this in motion and they see it face to face, they're amazed, huh?
Some are. The scientists are. The film crews really are kind of like, oh, well, you know, it's just, let's film it, call it a day towards the end of the day, and then put it on television. I think the best producer I had so far to date has been Griffin Productions, Peter Von Puck camera. He put his heart into making the Beyond Invention TV series.
Well, I guess they have to believe in this, don't they? They have to believe in the project.
Yeah, yeah. And the longest levitation we had was 15 minutes. That was with Rob Simone.
Oh, sure. No, Rob. Real well.
Yeah, he was here. And they filmed here for most of the day, and we had a 15-minute levitation.
What did you levitate?
It was an actual can of HGH powder.
Okay.
I was levitating for about 15 minutes, and luckily I caught a bit of it on my lab camera. But this show, who owns the show, is Polar Shift Film Productions. It has not aired yet, so I'm kind of hoping that it'll air soon.
When these objects levitate, do they shake, rattle, and roll, or do they just kind of like hover there?
Some of them will hover. Some of them have a ballistic liftoff where power is applied continuously, and they go right up and hit the ceiling. And sometimes these things will simply wobble around and go off to the side and fall on the floor. There are many different types of trajectories with these effects, with water, metals, pieces of machinery, bricks, all kinds of different objects. It's very interesting to watch it.
Let me just indicate that sound waves are often involved in this, too, because you can create canceling electromagnetic waves with sound. Now, this is not sound that you hear. For instance, 400, one of John's important frequencies is around 455 kilohertz. and that's in the high that's a phonon frequency in copper. And so you can get phonons and electrons going together or against one another and create canceling electromagnetic waves there. So phonon excitations in metals and materials is very important for us. And also this weaponry that the Soviets used, they're basically they're creating sound. It's not sound waves that you can hear because it's electromagnetic frequency. It's electromagnetic energy. It's not sound wave energy, but it's at sound wave frequencies.
Okay, now, if you were to build a real small device, you know, let's say maybe the size of, a small little radio, for example, what could that lift, John?
How cool that would be. Well, it would take scientific understanding on how to build something that small for it to work. It's much like the power cells, because they only put out a small amount of energy. But once understood, with serious engineering, you got some unique products for sure. Guaranteed.
It's not easy.
No, it's not easy, that's for sure. I mean,
you know, that's where people get the wrong impression. They think that you can just go, anybody can do this. You have to do it exactly right. Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Tesla was a perfectionist. John Hutchison, you're a perfectionist. You follow Tesla's work exactly.
You have to. You have to follow these engineers' work right to the letter.
Has there been any frustrating moments for you, John?
What side of life, George? I mean, I have always had frustrating moments.
How about the professional side here? This one.
Well, we took some samples to the University of British Columbia, and they were very interested in the metal samples until my partner said, well, because they asked how they got like that. We do anti-gravity research, and the professor said, oh, no, we don't touch that, and walked
right
away.
Yeah, it's nonsense. Like extraterrestrials, it's all nonsense. That's the American physicist. So many physicists in America are arrogant. We think, so many of us think, or not necessarily myself, but many, many, many American physicists think they know everything. They talk about theories of everything. Well, that's nonsense. 75% of the universe is made up of material, something we don't even know what it is. How, or 95% of the universe. How do we have a theory of everything if we don't even know, have the slightest idea what 95% of the universe is composed of.
Yeah. Well, I remember plunking down on Canadian research and development team with my business partner, another business partner, the free energy machine.
Yeah.
It was putting out 3 volts, 3 amps. The big thing is 55 pounds of these power cells and barium titanate. And they looked at it, they played with it and said, well, we don't know what to do with it. Why don't you take it to the military?
Of course. Everything goes to the military, doesn't it?
So my partner, Richard, he got quite kind of frustrated with it, and we carried it back out and put it in the trunk of his car. But that's another frustrating moment. You know, it's just like, huh? What's
new with you, John? What are you going to do now? I mean, you've worked on this. You've somewhat perfected it. What's next for you?
Well, there's a lot of interested folks in Germany now that are got part of the lab now and are going to be doing some research with it. I'm invited over there to actually fire it up in Germany. I'm going to be concentrating more on free energy with the power cells because it's got a lot of merits and can give the American people some hope. Also, I hope to go down to the Gulf and work with a journalist on testing frequencies on some waters down there that we already got samples of water up here, and actually she was able to reverse the effects of the water.
Now, let me emphasize that John's power cells don't use any kind of fuel. He has these chemical crystals that he puts together, and there's no you don't charge them up. They run on their own. You initially polarize it, but he can create these cells. He can put a jumper across them, a power cell, for a year or 6 months or 3 days, and come back, take the jumper cable off, and it'll still put out power.
So you don't have to expend energy to make this work, do you?
Not in this case, no. You make the initial mixture, and it is good for a long, long time. Now, the oldest power cell was made in 1993, and it was viewed by George Hathaway and Hal Pudoff. But the power cell,
an engineer and a physicist.
Yeah, I know Hal quite well. And when I came back here some months ago from Minnesota, I found some motors that are over unity. The government engineers sometimes will make over Unity motors, and it winds up in surplus, and sometimes I score these things. So I have now these motors that are about 20 pounds each, and I can put a power cell on, and it'll be powering that motor. So it'll be kind of a unique demonstration unit to show the people and get some interest going.
Sure.
And
could this be used in the house, John? Would it have applications there?
Yeah, I sure hope so. I've gone over engineers like Charles Bombardier, Hathaway, and many others on the applications of this, how big it would be, and how we can bring it down in size and that kind of thing. It would be pretty big to power a whole house. But
how about you, Bob? You're kind of a rogue physicist. I mean, how were you looked at because you believe in this kind of technology?
Well, I don't interact much anymore with most mainstream physicists. I have some friends that a physicist across the street who we laugh at a lot of this stuff. For instance, we laugh at the fact that, for instance, Michio Kaku talks about string theory, right?
Yes.
Well, there's nothing to string theory. Well, they've never. It's just a bunch of nonsense. How do you make a spherical? How do you turn a string into a spherical object? I want to know. You can't do it. They said the mass of the electron equals one. Well, the mass of the electron is the dimensional object. You can't do that. There's so much nonsense in American physics. You wouldn't believe it. They use the transverse gauge to analyze longitudinal effects for the electromagnetic radiation. You know, we think that our physicists are all geniuses. These academic types they know everything. Well, forget it. Some of them are dummies. And believe it or not, PhD theorists, some of them are just dumb.
Sometimes street smart is more important, doesn't it, Bob?
Well, they're arrogant. They think they can do anything. They use the transverse gauge to analyze longitudinal photons. How dumb can that be? You know what I'm saying? The transverse gauge is horizontal, and the other one's vertical. And you're using one system, orthogonal systems, to analyze the other. You know, it goes on and on and on. You don't assume that just because these guys have these degrees and have academic positions that they're really knowledgeable people.
No.
I don't, you know, there's nothing to my opinion, there's nothing to string theory. But, you know, people talk about it like it's the greatest thing in the world. Listen, if you get Michio Kaku on there, he's one of the world's leading experts in string theory. Let me debate him. Get some of these guys on there and let me debate him. I'll debate him. I want to know how you can turn a string into a sphere.
You might scare them away, Bob.
Well, it's topologically inconsistent. The other thing is we use high school algebra. 99% of these physicists use high school algebra. But high school algebra is often just total nonsense. You can't use high school algebra to analyze Hilbert space quantum physics. You know, you're adding negatives. What's a negative of an electron?
I don't know. That's why I'm talking to you guys. Hold on for just a second. We're talking with John Hutchison, Bob Kutz, about the Hutchison Effect. Their website's linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And definitely go take a look at that picture of that floating cannonball. It is very, very strange. I'll be back in a moment with your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.